This is Michael Reinhart, welcoming you to the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. We are led by our two hosts, Jerry Buckley and Jody Westby. This podcast is sponsored by the Association for Data and Cyber Governance. The association offers a 50% discount on membership to our podcast listeners when they go to www.adcg.org and use code POD. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and please feel free to leave us a rating or comment.
This is Jody Westby, and I'm here with my co-host, Jerry Buckley. Today, we are announcing a name change to our podcast. Its name will change from the U.S. National Privacy Legislation Podcast to the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. As we have seen over the past 18 months of lockdown and the flurry of privacy legislation at the state level, privacy and cybersecurity intersect. Without security, there is no privacy. Additionally, activities in these areas involve legislation and policy. So this name change will allow us to include cybersecurity more fully than we have in the past and to also cover policy aspects as well as legislation. So to help us make this transition, we are honored today to have as our guest Gary Korn, Program Director of the Technology Law and Security Program at American University's Washington College of Law. Gary's also an adjunct professor of cyber and national security law. I will say Gary is a giant in the space of cyber law. He's a retired Army colonel, is widely recognized as one of the nation's top experts on cyber and national security law. Professor Korn served over 27 years as an Army military attorney practicing national security law at the highest levels of the Department of Defense. His five final years, he served as staff judge advocate, which is the equivalent of general counsel, to the U.S. Cyber Command. Gary, it's such an honor to have you with us today. I followed your work for many years and learned from it as I developed my own writings in the area of cyber war and cyber conflict. So I'm really excited about today's discussion and having someone of your depth and breadth to talk about cyber. Let's start out by looking at the recent wave of cyber attacks involving ransomware and SolarWinds, and consider the nation-state involvement in these attacks. Russia was blamed for SolarWinds, and certainly Russia's been a key player in many of the ransomware attacks. I'm not implying they're the only bad actor out there, but they've been grabbing the headlines lately. You have had an inside view into what nation-states were up to in your role at Cyber Command. Can you tell our listeners just how bad are nation-state attacks? Are these occasional events, or have they become so commonplace that companies really need to prepare to respond to and defend against a nation-state attack?
Yeah, Jody, Jerry, thanks for the invitation to be here with you guys today. Congratulations on your podcast and the name change. I appreciate the introduction, although when my wife uses the term giant to describe me, it's usually followed by "you're a giant pain," and I'll leave it at that.
We're screwed up.
Let's put it in perspective. There's a lot to that question. I will say this. States have absolutely, figured out that using internet telecommunications technology is a lucrative means and method of engaging in all sorts of statecraft. And there are certain states that are far more sort of aggressive in that realm, Russia being one of them. The government often points out and tracks Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran as the primary sort of threat problems in this space. In terms of frequency, it is constant. It is constant. It's a little hard to say whether any given operation reaches a sort of certain level of gravity or not. SolarWinds was a very broad-based access generating operation. It impacted numerous different systems, companies, networks. But, at some level, that was sort of a broad reconnaissance through a supply chain operation. And Russia didn't necessarily go beyond that initial access point on a lot of those systems. So, depending on where you are in the victim chain, the consequences can be very different. But let's not kid ourselves. I mean, we saw with sort of the impact of Colonial Pipeline, we've seen other operations, both against the United States and internationally, where this medium can have huge impact. And it's not only, as we're sadly sort of catching up and figuring out, it's not just the impact of, you know, the breach and the release of information, the impact on the confidentiality, availability, integrity of information and the systems themselves. It's the impact of using the larger internet ecosystem as it's designed and intended to disseminate harmful content and information as well. And so we see states now moving very aggressively into the influence space, you know, with these capabilities. So it is a real threat. It's a daily threat. And companies really do need to pay attention and I think take a much more operational approach to cybersecurity within their organizations.
Well, certainly when you say it is constant, that's what the cybersecurity researchers that I interact with say as well, that it's constant, whether it's pure nation state or state patronage of, you know, other groups acting at the behest of or with the assistance of. So that's a great answer. Thank you for that. Jerry, let me hand this to you.
Well, thanks, Jody. And Gary, I want to join Jody in welcoming you and saying how privileged we are to have you as a guest today. Your background is really impressive, and your body of work certainly places you in the top among the top authorities on how cyber attacks fit into the U.S. and international legal frameworks, including the law of armed conflict. And may I add, as a fellow faculty member at the Washington College of Law, I am so glad that you agreed to bring your extraordinary talents to the AU Law School faculty. It's great to have you there. I think we can all agree that it is so important for companies to understand that they and the government can legally, what they and the government can legally do when responding to attacks involving nation states. Let's start with the U.S. legal framework. If a company believes it is being hit with a cyber attack that involves a nation state involvement or support, what can they do? Can they get help from the government? And if so, from whom? And can the cyber command also get involved?
Yeah, great question. Let me take the last part of that first, the sort of role of cyber command and what it can or can't do. And I think we'll come back to this in some follow-on questions. But cyber command, in recognition, you know, the Department of Defense and cyber command, in recognition of the growing threat space here and the national security threat that we've just described, and a recognition that the vast majority, not all, but the vast majority of these harmful, malicious cyber operations are happening outside of typical situations of armed conflict, the command has moved into a space of more proactive measures to counter these malicious cyber operations. So, you know, that's a out of network. What we say in the military is out of blue space, meaning out of U.S. network sort of operations overseas, trying to disrupt these activities as far forward as possible before they impact. So there's a role to play there in terms of what cyber command might or might not do domestically. Generally, it doesn't engage in operations domestically. We have a strong legal tradition there. How we architect the federal government responses and missions, roles, and responsibilities places that more with the FBI and DHS through CISA. But there's different aspects to all this as well. There's sort of information sharing aspects. There's mitigation and response aspects. And those fall kind of differently across the federal government. There are circumstances in which, through very traditional support roles, the other departments and agencies can reach to the Department of Defense and request support. And Cyber Command does have capabilities that we would say are more of, you know, that mitigation role, internal network defense type teams trained to do that type of operation. But they would do that, as I said, in support of either the DHS or the FBI under a given circumstance. They wouldn't have that as a lead responsibility. So one of the things, you know, and again, I spent most of my career time working on these problems, as you noted, with the DOD and Cyber Command. But I do know that this is a very serious source of frustration for the private sector and companies, because we've gotten much better, but we're still not at a point where you have sort of a one place to call when you have a problem. So the FBI has certain legal authorities and responsibilities. Those are more in the law enforcement investigative realm. We've seen reports recently where, you know, sometimes those authorities and in the course of investigations that can be leveraged to disrupt ongoing malicious cyber activity, and that's powerful. But I would say companies need to establish relationships and exercise those relationships with the local field offices of the FBI, as well as, you know, IC3, the Internet Crime Complaint Center, and sort of the cyber team at Maine FBI, but also with CISA. CISA has certain roles. Their primary function is dealing with critical infrastructure sectors and with the .gov aspect of federal networks. But there's, you know, if you go to CISA's webpage, there are some instructions of the ways to report a cyber incident, which is pretty much any malicious cyber activity that you might discover happening against your network. So, you know, it's really important to establish those relationships, exercise them as part of your cybersecurity sort of response plans so that you're not trying to figure that out in the moment of a crisis. And then, you know, let the government exercise its responsibilities there. One thing that often comes up is, you know, the hackback discussion. That is, you know, in a nutshell, for private entities, talk to your general's counsel, because that is basically a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and maybe some other federal statutes. So it's not lawful to engage in the type of out-of-network operations that I described that Cyber Command might engage in, and can have really significant implications if private sector entities start doing that, because, you know, they're not in a position to evaluate how the states where those operations might impact will interpret that and whether that's creating risk for the nation as a whole about how they might react and respond.
I often advise my clients who may be critical infrastructure companies to have a point of contact with their liaison federal agency. So banks, you know, with Treasury and with Secret Service, or with energy, with the energy ISAC. And I tell them one of the reasons is because then if they do need federal government support, it can go through to that point of contact in the federal agency, and that federal agency can then reach over to DOD and to DHS and to request assistance. Is that appropriate? You were saying with FBI or Secret Service, but that means they would have to actually go to law enforcement first and then request government, but they could actually request some assistance from the government if they go through their federal coordinating agency, couldn't they?
No, that's absolutely true. You know, not all private sector companies or entities fall within the critical infrastructure buckets, right, which creates some challenge and confusion. And CISA has primary responsibility for, I think, 8 of the 16, I think we're at 16, critical infrastructure sectors, right? And then some of the other departments and agencies, like the DOD is the sector-specific agency for the defense industrial base.
Right.
And so, yes, I mean, there are structures and organizations there that you should be familiar with and know if you fit into one of the critical infrastructure sectors, do you have an ISAC or an ISAO, right? And establish those relationships, absolutely. And as I said, even on the CISA website, you know, there's just a generic how to report a cyber incident to CISA. And where we've gotten much better is whoever gets that intake, or whatever that intake point is, it should trigger coordination across all of the relevant departments and agencies that have different roles and responsibilities for these problems. Yeah. And you know, I'll just put in a plug here. One of the things I've seen in exercises we did and tabletops and other discussions, understandably so, but you know, a lot of private sector, you know, companies and entities, their primary concern and focus when they have an incident is obviously, you know, containing it and getting services back up and running for customers. And there's sometimes a bit of a soda straw look at this problem. That can be really unfortunate, because this might seem like an isolated incident, ransomware or whatever, but it could very much be fitting into a much bigger picture that, right, the departments and agencies that have the broader intelligence picture and insight can figure that out. So the information sharing and flow should also be part of the thinking and the and triggered when you have an event.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you.
So, Gary, what about the SolarWinds software breach that hit the public and private sector companies? Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, known as SVR, is widely believed to be behind that attack. It hit government and private sector systems and was one of the worst cyber attacks this country has ever had, as has already been mentioned. In your January 2021 paper titled SolarWinds is Bad, but Retreat from Defend Forward Would Be Worse, you stand up for the Defense Department's 2018 strategy of Defend Forward and Persistent Engagement. What are, for the benefit of our audience, what are these terms? And are there activities or things that the government can be doing on an ongoing basis that will help government agencies and departments and private sector organizations be safer from cyber attacks? Can the military teach the private sector how to do forward defense and persistent engagement? And, you know, given what we've already covered here, it is so clear that the internet is a borderless medium, and that the risks to our national security and to our economy are so great that new thinking has happened, but probably a lot more is needed. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the forward defense piece is one has to be a lot more careful for reasons we've already discussed. I mean, there certainly are circumstances where working through, you know, the FBI, et cetera, you know, major providers, Microsoft, et cetera, might have the ability through law enforcement actions and authorities, you know, in conjunction, you know, cooperation with federal law enforcement or going through legal process to do some sort of broad infrastructure takedowns and disrupt the malicious operations and the infrastructure that these actors are using. But as a general matter, forward defense, the concept of defend forward that I was writing about in that, is a concept that is embedded in the 2018 DoD cyber strategy, which is, again, disrupting forward, right? It's out of, in a nutshell, it's out of network operations to counter and disrupt adversary hostile cyber operations and activities. It's something that the Solarium Commission, which was, you know, set in place by statute, basically endorsed in its final report as part of a broader approach to cyber strategy for the United States. That's this concept there, which is different than persistent engagement. They get confused a lot in discussions. Persistent engagement is more of a, in my perspective, a command philosophy that's saying that this is a constant problem, that the adversaries are maneuvering and acting against us on a constant basis. And we can't continue to cede initiative. We have to seize initiative. We have to be persistent in everything we're doing operationally in this space. And that includes, if you read this command vision from the same year describing persistence, it's also sort of persistence in establishing partnerships and cooperation, right? It's persistence in innovation and continue to make sure that we have the best and most innovative workforce and tools and capabilities. So it's persistent engagement is not just about, you know, constantly conducting operations out forward. It's much broader than that as a command philosophy driving how we think about this space. And all of that stems from, and there's writings from a gentleman named Mike Fisher-Keller with IDA, the Institute of Defense Analysis, and Richard Harknett at University of Cincinnati, and some others. But prior to sort of that time period, 2018, the general approach that we were taking was one of, and these were stated open policies, of policy of restraint, sort of not conducting active operations in and through cyberspace on the notion that that would sort of set the tone for appropriate behavior in the space. And I think that empirically, that just was found to be not accurate. And it was actually inviting more malicious activity from our primary adversaries because they saw there was no risk or consequence to acting. And so that's where you started to see this shift in strategy. And you saw it also on the congressional side in the passage of various statutes to sort of enable and authorize a more proactive stance to conduct more of these out-of-network operations. You know, it's not a panacea. It's not going to catch and disrupt everything, but it is an effort to sort of set the security conditions, seizing the initiative, and, you know, setting those conditions more in the U.S.'s security favor, as at the same time you're moving forward with diplomatic efforts and norm-setting efforts and trying to shape the behavior overall of players in this space, and especially of like-minded states that are out there.
You know, Gary, as you talk, my mind goes back to some of the initial naval engagements and our decision to go after the Barbary pirates in the Mediterranean, who were harassing our commercial shipping. And we decided, well, you know, nation states aren't necessarily claiming responsibility for them, but we're going to go after them and essentially, you know, shut them down. Didn't work perfectly, but it was enough to deter them. And we're very much dealing with the Barbary pirates of the 21st century. So anyway, that's the analogy that occurs to me.
It's a fair analogy. And there's, you know, sort of more recent analogies there in terms of counter-piracy operations off the Horn of Africa, right? But, you know, I've often described, when I think about this space, you know, the deterrence discussion always comes up. And one of the things that I kind of tried to set out in that piece that you referenced was defend forward really isn't, certainly not directly, about deterrence. It's not a deterrence strategy. And in part, that's, or in large measure, that's because of a recognition that the cost-benefit analysis to our adversaries for engaging in these operations is still at a point where you really can't deter them. All right. Deterrence usually is about an inchoate threat of consequence, right? I have a credible threat that if you do what I don't want you to do, I'm going to impose punishment or cost. But we're past that. This is where we're in the engagement. It's kind of like intelligence operations where that's just too important and lucrative to adversaries. They're not going to be deterred from conducting intelligence operations. And so we engage in counterintelligence operations to disrupt and defeat their success and to be better at it and set those conditions. And, you know, there's other analogies out there, but it's a very different sort of construct and mindset.
Gary, the ransom attacks have been a pandemic of their own in the last, at least certainly 6-8 months. As you note in your very recent article, which was just last week, August 23, in Just Security, it was entitled, for our listeners, International Law's Role in Combating Ransomware. You rightly note that ransomware is a national security issue and it poses a threat to critical infrastructure, the economy, and basic public services. We saw that, of course, with Colonial Pipeline and the meatpacking plant. You also note that President Biden has responded by saying the U.S. will no longer respond to ransomware attacks solely through law enforcement. He said the U.S. would possibly take actions against the infrastructure involved in an attack. So that was a big step to take. But how does that happen legally? How can the U.S. legally target for disruption overseas infrastructure of state or non-state actors? Would Cyber Command take such actions or what?
Well, whether or not Cyber Command will take those actions is really a function of whether the president turns to the Department of Defense and directs that right entity with its capability and capacity to engage in those operations. There's a domestic law side of this, and there's an international law side to all this. I was speaking more to the international law questions in that article, but there were some other articles that have come up in regard to this with sort of botnet disruptions. There was a reports of a trick bot takedown at some point not too long ago that, you know, whether accurate or not, was pointing back to U.S. Cyber Command. And some debates have sort of surfaced about whether or not it's appropriate for the DOD and Cyber Command to be engaging in quote unquote law enforcement activities. Well, going back to the discussion of the Barbary pirates, there's lots of history where, as a national asset, presidents have tasked the military to engage in all sorts of different types of operations that wouldn't fit neatly into the bucket of sort of break glass in time of war. That's a constitutional law question about what authorities the president has. And are those authorities sort of solely vested in the president under Article 2 of the Constitution as commander in chief, et cetera? But here, I mean, we've got legislation from Congress that certainly with respect to activities and operations being conducted by the big four, as we say, the Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, directing or authorizing the cyber command, DOD through the cyber command, to conduct disruptive operations in a space which is not armed conflict. So there would be a domestic law discussion and question about the president's authority to direct the command to do that. There are ways to do that. I don't know where they are in the thinking or in the process and how much President Biden has sort of directed action beyond sending the message to President Putin. So that's sort of behind curtains. There's a separate international law question. International law does matter. We are a rule of law nation to include supporting and developing the international rules-based order. There's certainly uncertainty about how some of the existing international law maps over to cyberspace, especially outside of situations of armed conflict. It's, in my opinion, not completely clear, but it's much clearer in the circumstance of when you're using these capabilities as part of an armed conflict.
Yeah.
Right. But that's what I was sort of talking about. There are things you could do to disrupt that could be done consistent with existing international law.
Well, so let's talk about the international legal framework. There are the laws of armed conflict, and in their present form, at least in my view, they do not fully address cyber war. I put cyber conflict into that gray zone of aggressive nation-state cyber activities that fall short of what we would call an armed attack. This recent stuff from Russia, I would say, falls in that zone of aggressive nation-state cyber activities that we would not call cyber warfare, but I would call it a cyber conflict, or at least within that gray zone. Does that make sense to you? I know you've thought about this so much more than I have, but also I know that NATO said a cyber attack on one NATO member could trigger the Article 5 collective response, but the rest of the international framework, legal framework, is kind of fuzzy and leaves a lot of room for interpretations. What are your thoughts on this? How well do our international legal frameworks address cyber actions for warfare and aggressive nation-state attacks such as SolarWinds and the attack on Colonial Pipeline? And are these voluntary norms you mentioned that we negotiated at the UN effective or enough?
So I'll come back to the voluntary norms discussion. Yeah. And I'm glad that I agree in part and disagree in part overall, because when we talk about it in more broad general terms about cyber conflict, that's fairly a broader concept that captures a lot more of harmful cyber operations and activities. I personally eschew, adjectives in front of warfare that somehow try to create it as a sui generis form of warfare. Warfare is warfare, mm-hmm. right? And international law addresses it as such. And so, one of the most developed bodies of international law that we have is the law of armed conflict, right? But the law of armed conflict applies to a very specific set of circumstances. When you have two states in the matter of international armed conflict, right, war between states, there's a triggering moment that brings this body of law forward, and it regulates how the parties to a conflict engage in those hostilities. Mm-hmm. And I think that the law of armed conflict, by and large, is fairly adequate to deal with these questions when the capabilities, cyber capabilities, are used as a means and method of warfare in the course of an armed conflict. There are certainly edge areas. What happens if your cyber operation, what constitutes an act of violence in and through cyberspace that triggers what we would say the traditional targeting rules that requires distinction, proportionality, right? Not targeting civilians or civilian objects, et cetera. But those laws, by and large, those rules are pretty robust and I think capture in large measure a lot of these activities. It's this other area, which is really the law that regulates interstate relations, right? Different than the law of armed conflict, which regulates how a party to a conflict engages with the individuals, right, in the conduct of belligerency. This is the interstate relations piece You know, the NATO Article 5 declaration is one that has to do with collective national self-defense as addressed in the NATO treaty. Mm-hmm. And their declaration is one of saying you can engage in an armed attack in and through cyberspace if you generate the type of consequences and harm that reaches a certain scale and effects. States will consider that to be an armed attack under Article 51 of the UN Charter, triggering the right of self-defense to use and respond with force to that event, just like they would by kinetic operations. Now, there's certainly edge uncertainty. Most states are coming out and agreeing that a cyber operation that generates the same type of harm as, you know, what you would get from dropping, you know, bombs and munitions would put you in the same place legally. But, you know, states are also the Netherlands, France, there are others that are starting to push boundaries here and say, but there may be some harms that aren't as traditionally physical, but certainly of a consequence to the lifeblood of a nation. And in the case of France and the Netherlands, they've talked about substantial economic harm, you know, through operations against financial sectors. They might consider that to be a use of force, which is prohibited in the UN Charter as a means of international relations. So, and as you move away from that, as you move below the, what we say, the jus ad bellum, this body of law that governs when states can resort to force in their international relations, it does become less clear. It does become dicier. There's a separate issue about human rights law and how that governs these operations. There's sort of non-cyber related open questions about human rights law, jurisdictional issues. Does it apply extraterritorially or not? The United States, for example, is very firm in its view that the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights doesn't have extraterritorial applicability other than to how it engages with its own citizens. Other states take different views. So there's far more uncertainty in this space outside of a situation of actual armed conflict. And a lot of debates happening right now about what the contours of international law are in that space, you know, whether certain rules exist or are they principles? And if they do exist, what are the parameters of those rules? And do they put constraints on how states use this medium to engage with each other?
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Gary?
You know, I spent a portion of the early part of my career as the minority staff director of the Senate Banking Committee. So my mind immediately goes to the approach one would take when considering developing a legal framework. There are certainly a lot of considerations to think about, as you've just noted. What are your thoughts about how nations should go about developing an international legal framework for cyber actions? And should this be something that the United States would take a lead on and get like-minded countries to jointly advance these issues at the UN or in some other forum?
Yeah, this is a really difficult question. You know, the US has typically led in the sort of formulation of international law, but it's always been in somewhat of a unique position in sort of assessing when it should bind itself or not on any given sort of issue or capability. We have, and you know, back to the earlier question, we have the norms development process at the UNGGE. You know, that's a fair process. It's starting to give indications of where certainly some states think appropriate behavior lines lie. But I think it lacks any type of real implementation or enforcement mechanisms. And so I'm not sure how effective those norms are to this point. I also think it's going to be quite difficult given the, you know, we forget that this medium is pretty new and it's always evolving and it's evolving rapidly. That's a tough environment for a state to sort of step back, take a deep breath and say, it is to my greater benefit to sign up to something that restricts my sovereign prerogatives here to engage, right, with other states, to use these capabilities to advance our interests or to defend our interests. It's better to just put a lid on that versus preserving maneuver space and discretion. So that's one of the things I noted in the article on just security is you have to approach this cautiously. That was the tenor of a speech by the Deputy Attorney General in Israel about a year ago up at the Naval War College. So I don't know that we'll see the impetus anytime soon to bring enough states together to sort of create a treaty regime or something. I think that's going to be extremely hard. And so this is an area of development in the area of, we say, customary international law, state practice over time, that practice being adhered to out of a sense of legal obligation by various states. We're certainly seeing more and more pronouncements by states on this, which is giving their views about that opinio iuris piece, the legal obligation piece. That's good. I mean, it starts to get a better sense of clarity. I think there's real need to kind of lead in this space, but lead in this space with the right set of states as your partners in this discussion, because I just don't think some of the worst actors in this space will do as they say, they'll do as they do.
Very useful point. And, you know, your article, your recent Just Security article, you discuss cyber due diligence. Can you explain what that concept is for our listeners?
Sure. This sort of traces back to more general theories in international law, sort of positions or principles that one should not use one's own territory, right, or allow one's own territory to be used to the harm of other states. This is something that has played out far more in international environmental law and different arbitration decisions there. You know, we had the Trail Smelter arbitration between the United States and Canada, where there were, you know, harmful emissions, et cetera, coming across the border. And so there's been discussions about whether this, again, is a general rule of international law, or if it was something that was very sort of limited and developed in the context of environmental law, that would essentially put a duty on states to take action to not allow its territory. And in this case, you're talking about the use of infrastructure in third-party states, right? You might not have non-state actors or criminals operating from your territory, and to this duty to sort of take action to disrupt those activities. But there's a lot of difficulty and controversy around it, because some would argue that for that to be effective, you have to have a duty to prevent those activities, which implicates a duty to monitor networks and systems, which implicates all kinds of privacy and human rights questions that aren't implicated really in the environmental context. So, you know, I said in that article, this due diligence concept is written into the UNGGE non-binding norms so far. And as a general concept, you know, a rising tide floats all boats, and that's a good thing. I think putting pressure on states to better police, as I said, their corners of the internet to try and tamp down this kind of malicious activity is a good thing. But, you know, whether or not this has crystallized into a cyber-specific rule of conduct for states is a tougher question. And it's very much an open question.
Well, this half hour has flown by and we barely scratched the surface. Let me ask you one last quick question before we close. What do you think private sector should be doing? What do you see as the key actions that they need to be taking, or that policymakers or legislators need to be taking regarding private sector cybersecurity?
You know, I think that we need to, in effect, reduce attack surface and build in resiliency to mitigate the impacts of these various cyber operations, incidents, et cetera. You know, that I understand is tough. It's a business decision. At the end of the day, it costs money, time, and resources. But this is not something that I think you can generally sort of put in a firewall and move on and forget about it. It is a constant vigilance question. It needs to be built into operations. And I think across the public and private sector, we've been having this discussion for a long time about public-private cooperation and information sharing and flowing. And those are all real issues, and there needs to be better structure there and figure out how do we incentivize the system to do that better, right? There's lots of levers we can pull on. Some might be regulatory. We have legislation pending right now that would require broader breach notification requirements beyond just the release of PII. Mm-hmm. I think that's, me personally, a good thing, because we need a broader sight picture of what's happening.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of different nuances to that discussion that we've got to work through and kind of break down the obstacles to better cooperation.
So we need a commitment at the top, and we need the resources allocated and constant attention. So companies have to spend money. I guess that's one bottom line.
Well, and the government, I think, has to facilitate that in certain ways. I mean, there could be tax incentives. There's a whole lots of levers you could pull, but I don't think we should just throw the companies out there on their own. But the reality is, like, the government has to prioritize where it's going to put its efforts, and there are going to be companies that are going to fall outside of that bubble, and they need to take on a greater role in reducing their attack surface.
Well, thank you so much, Jerry. I know you want
to. I just wanted to say again, echo Jody in saying thank you. I mean, what is obvious is we are in the midst of an enormous transition, and the issues are made clearer by commentary like yours. But we have quite a ways to go. And thank you for helping us think through these issues. We appreciate your being a guest.
Sure, my pleasure. I appreciate you inviting me.
Thanks for joining us this week on U.S. national privacy legislation. Make sure to visit our website, adcg.org, where you can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Cast, or via RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in what you heard today, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the podcast, that would help us out too. Also, you might want to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Data and Cyber Governance Alert, which you can do right on our homepage. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode, where we dig deeper into the possibilities of U.S. national privacy legislation.